the arrest of Stephen Richard Hensley sent a shockwave through Garden Grove. For 37 years, he had lived as an ordinary man, working jobs, paying bills, blending into the background of Southern California life. But now, the DNA beneath Shannon Rose Lloyd's fingernails had pulled him into the harsh light of a courtroom. Detective Karen Holt had spent months preparing for this moment. The evidence was airtight, but the case was anything but easy. Prosecutors knew the defense would attack every detail. The age of the samples, the chain of custody, the possibility of contamination. The trial would be a battle not only over facts, but over the idea that justice can still stand after decades. For Shannon's family, walking into the courthouse was like reopening an old wound that had never fully healed. Her mother, Patricia, had waited most of her life to see the man accused of killing her daughter held accountable. Every step through the marble halls brought back 1984. The phone call, the police cars, the endless nights of not knowing. Inside the courtroom, Hensley sat at the defense table in a dark suit, hands folded, expression unreadable. The jury, 12 strangers tasked with deciding his fate, would hear about the violent night Shannon was killed, the evidence sealed away for decades, and the science that had finally broken the silence. The trial would test everyone. The investigators who had carried the weight of the case, the forensic experts defending their methods, and a family determined not to let time dull the truth. And even when the verdict came, there would still be one more step. Sentencing day, when the court would decide how the rest of Hensley's life would be spent. This is the final act in a story that began in a quiet apartment on a May night in 1984. It's about what happens when science, persistence, and the refusal to forget finally collide with the justice system. And whether, after a lifetime of waiting, justice still feels like enough. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 11, Sentencing Day. Sentencing days are quieter than verdict days. The crowds are smaller, the tension less about uncertainty and more about finality. For families like the Lloyds, it's the last official chapter in a case that has consumed decades of their lives. On the morning of Stephen Richard Hensley's sentencing, the Orange County Superior Court was calm. The media presence was still there, but without the crush of cameras that had filled the steps during the trial. The headlines had already been written. Convicted in 1984 murder, man faces life in prison. Now it was a matter of hearing the words from the judge's mouth. Detective Karen Holt arrived early. She didn't have to be there. Her job was technically done, but she knew the Lloyds would want to see her. Patricia and her son Mark were seated in the front row, dressed in black. Patricia's hands were clasped tightly in her lap, the way they had been on verdict day. She'd told Holt the night before, "I just want to hear it said out loud. I want it on the record forever." Hensley was brought in wearing the standard orange jail jumpsuit. He looked older than he had during the trial, the weeks in custody carving new lines into his face. His hands were cuffed in front of him, his gait slow but steady. He glanced briefly toward the gallery, but didn't acknowledge the family. Judge Ellen Vargas took the bench promptly at 9 a.m. The case was called and the clerk read the charge aloud. Count 1, murder in the first degree verdict, guilty. Before sentencing, the court allowed for victim impact statements. Patricia stood first. She walked to the podium with a folded sheet of paper in her hand, but when she began speaking, she didn't look at it. "Shannon was my daughter. She was my best friend. She was taken from me in the most violent way imaginable. For 37 years, I woke up every day wondering if her killer was still walking free, wondering if I'd pass him in the grocery store or at the gas station. I prayed for this day. I prayed that someone would have to answer for what they did to her. And now you will, Mr. Hensley." Her voice didn't shake, but her eyes stayed locked on Hensley the entire time. He didn't look back. Mark spoke next. His statement was shorter, but no less direct. "When you killed my sister, you took more than her life. You took every holiday, every birthday, every moment our family could have had with her. You stole decades from us. And for what? You can never give them back. But today, you will lose your freedom, the way you took hers." The prosecutor, Michael Reyes, made a brief statement, urging the court to impose the maximum sentence allowed by law. This was a senseless act of violence against a young woman in her own home. The defendant lived his life for nearly four decades, while the victim's family lived with a wound that never healed. the only just outcome is life in prison without the possibility of parole. When it was the defense's turn, Hensley's attorney, James Corcoran, asked the court for leniency, citing his client's age and lack of prior violent convictions. Mr. Hensley has maintained his innocence from the beginning. We ask the court to consider his advanced years and the fact that he has lived peacefully for much of his life. Judge Vargas listened without interruption, then turned to Hensley. Mr. Hensley, you have been convicted by a jury of your peers of the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd. The evidence against you was strong, and the jury found it compelling. You took the life of a young woman in her own home, a place where she had every right to feel safe. For 37 years, you lived free while her family lived in pain. That ends today. She sentenced him to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Patricia exhaled audibly. It was the sound of something leaving her after decades. Not joy, not relief exactly, but a release. Hensley was escorted out of the courtroom without speaking. He didn't look back at the Lloyds. He didn't ask for a final word. Outside the courthouse, Patricia and Mark stood with Holt and Reyes for a brief press conference. Patricia spoke first. Justice is never late if it comes. Today we got it for Shannon. I want other families with cold cases to know. Don't stop asking. Don't stop calling. Your loved one's case matters. The cameras clicked, reporters shouted questions, but Patricia didn't take any. She had said what she came to say. Back inside, the court staff began clearing the docket for the next case. For them, it was just another day's work. But for the Lloyd family, it was the end of a 37-year fight and the start of life after justice. Holt told me later that sentencing days are bittersweet. You get the win, but you also know it doesn't bring the person back. It's closure, but not the kind that fills the hole. That night, Patricia lit a single candle on her kitchen table, beside a framed photo of Shannon. She didn't celebrate. She didn't cry. She just sat there, quiet, letting the weight of the day settle. The trial was over. The sentence was handed down. And for the first time since 1984, the case file could be stamped closed. Chapter 12, Lessons in Justice. Every cold case that finally ends in a conviction leaves behind more than just a closed file. It leaves a trail of lessons, some about the law, some about science, and some about people. In the weeks after Stephen Richard Hensley was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd, I spent hours in conversation with Detective Karen Holt. She was still decompressing from the trial, still adjusting to the fact that she'd actually achieved what every cold case investigator dreams of. Taking a file that was older than her police career and turning it into a conviction. It's funny, she told me. You think the lesson is going to be about DNA. And sure, the science is huge. But the real lesson here was persistence. If Shannon's evidence had been thrown out in the 90s, if her file had been lost in one of the department moves, we'd have nothing. This case only got solved because somebody, every step of the way, kept it alive. That chain of somebody stretched back to 1984. The first officers who collected the evidence and sealed it properly, the cold case auditors in 2011 who noted it was viable for future testing, and Holt herself, who pushed it to the top of the priority list when she took over in 2021. Without any one of them, the chain would have broken. The science did matter, of course. In talking with Paul Rivera, the forensic analyst who handled the DNA testing, I learned just how fragile the process was. You're talking about 37-year-old skin cells, he explained. That's not a lot to work with. We had to use low copy number DNA methods and handle it in a sterile environment. And even then, you hold your breath until the profile comes up on the screen. Rivera said the second lab's verification was the real game changer. The defense can argue contamination all day, but when two labs get the same result independently, that's bulletproof in court. But lessons in justice aren't always about the technical wins. Some of the biggest takeaways from Shannon's case were about patience and expectation. For her family, the decades of waiting were almost as punishing as the crime itself. Patricia Lloyd had to live in a world where her daughter's killer was a free man. That shaped every holiday, every anniversary, every casual interaction with a stranger who might, for all she knew, have been the one. People think closure means you feel better. Patricia told me after the sentencing. It doesn't. Closure means you can stop asking the same question every day. That's all. Holt took something else from this case. The need for systematic cold case prioritization. If you've got evidence in good condition, it needs to be tested now. Don't wait for a better time or more funding. The longer you wait, the more you risk losing. Her department is now in the process of creating a database to track every unsolved homicide by evidence viability, not just by case age. Shannon's case is being used internally as an example of why that matters. The DA's office learned a lesson too: how to try a case with evidence that predates DNA testing entirely. Deputy District Attorney Michael Reyes told me, "We had to educate the jury on 1984 police work and 2021 forensic science in the same breath. It's not easy to explain why something wasn't tested for DNA in 1984 without making it sound like a mistake. We had to frame it as the reality of the time, and then show how the evidence survived long enough for us to get to it." Even the defense's strategy had lessons. By attacking the age of the evidence and the possibility of contamination, they were trying to chip away at the certainty that DNA usually carries in modern juries. It didn't work this time, but it underscored the need for airtight chain of custody documentation in any cold case brought to trial. There was one final lesson, though, the one that stuck with me most. It came from something Patricia said during our last interview for this story. We were sitting at her kitchen table, the same table where Holt had told her about the arrest months earlier. The candle she'd lit on sentencing night was still there, unburned since. "You know what I learned?" Patricia said. "That time isn't what kills cases. People giving up is what kills them. Time can help you if you let it. New science, new detectives, new ways of looking at the same old thing. You just have to hold on long enough for your turn to come." Shannon's turn came 37 years after her last breath. For the Lloyd family, justice was a long, uneven road that ended in a courtroom with a single word: guilty. And for every detective still working the cases that seem impossible, Shannon's case now sits as proof that impossible doesn't mean forever. Chapter 13, The Ripple Effect. When the verdict came down in the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd, the headlines were immediate. But what happened in the months afterward was quieter, and in some ways more important. Shannon's case didn't just bring closure to one family. It shook loose a wave of change that rippled through law enforcement agencies across Southern California and beyond. The same week Stephen Richard Hensley was sentenced, I received an email from a detective in San Diego who'd been following the case closely. His message was short: "We've got a box just like yours. Time to open it." Detective Karen Holt wasn't surprised. The moment you prove a 37-year-old case can be solved, every other cold case detective looks at their shelves differently, she told me. "It's not just a theory anymore, it's a roadmap." The roadmap, as Holt described it, had three main points. Preservation matters. If evidence is stored correctly, decades-old samples can still yield results. Prioritize by viability, not age. Focus first on cases with preserved biological evidence, regardless of when the crime occurred. Push for testing now. Waiting for the right time risks losing the opportunity altogether. In the months following Hensley's conviction, Garden Grove PD submitted 8 other cold cases for DNA testing. 2 of them came back with hits in CODIS. Both are now active investigations, though the department hasn't released details. The ripple spread beyond Garden Grove. The Orange County District Attorney's Office created a dedicated cold case task force, bringing together prosecutors, forensic analysts, and detectives from multiple cities. Holt was asked to be one of the lead advisors, using Shannon's case as the blueprint for building airtight prosecutions on decades-old evidence. One of the biggest impacts came from a surprising place: budget meetings. City councils and county boards, often reluctant to spend on cold case work, now had a tangible success story to point to. Shannon's case showed that funding forensic testing wasn't just throwing money into the wind. It could deliver results that mattered to real families. But the ripple wasn't limited to law enforcement. Shannon's story began appearing in advocacy circles focused on unsolved homicides. Patricia Lloyd was invited to speak at a national conference for families of murder victims. She stood on stage in front of more than 200 people, most of them still waiting for answers, and told them not to stop calling their detectives. "Be the voice that keeps your case alive," she said. "If I could wait 37 years and still get my answer, you can too." Forensic labs took notice as well. Rivera, the analyst who worked Shannon's evidence, told me his lab used the case as part of training for new hires. "We show them the original envelopes from 1984, he said. We talk about chain of custody, about low-copy DNA techniques, about the importance of double verification. It's a lesson in both science and patience. Of course, the ripple wasn't purely positive. Defense attorneys began preparing for a new wave of cold case prosecutions, sharpening their strategies for attacking old evidence. In workshops and seminars, they discussed contamination risks, witness memory decay, and the challenge of reconstructing crime scenes decades later. Shannon's case had proven the state could win, but it also gave the defense bar a template for how to fight back. Holt understood that reality. "Every case after this will be harder," she said. "The defense will point to any weakness, any gap in the timeline, any missing page from the file. That's why we have to be better. We have to know these cases inside out before we ever walk into court." The ripple even reached the public. True crime forums dissected Shannon's case, debating how DNA technology had evolved and whether similar breakthroughs were likely in other cold cases. On social media, hashtags like #testtheevidence began circulating, driven by families urging police to re-examine old files. One story that stuck with me came from Riverside County. A woman named Carol messaged me after reading an article I'd written on the case. Her sister had been murdered in 1989, and for years, the police told her there was nothing left to test. After seeing Shannon's case, she pushed again. This time, the department agreed to recheck the evidence. 2 months later, Carol called me, her voice shaking. "They found DNA. They're sending it to the lab now. Not every ripple ends in justice, but each one creates the possibility. And in the world of cold cases, possibility is often the most precious thing a family can have." Shannon's case also sparked an internal culture shift in Garden Grove PD. Holt started a monthly cold case review meeting, where detectives present their dormant files and brainstorm fresh strategies. The room has a rule: no case is too old to matter, and no suggestion is off the table. The lesson, Holt said, is that the value of a solved case isn't measured only in convictions. It's measured in momentum. When you show people it's possible, they start to believe again. And when they believe, they work harder. The ripple effect of Shannon's case is still moving outward. Some waves will reach other cities, other families, other courtrooms. Some will fade quietly. But the fact that they began at all, in a dusty evidence room, with an envelope sealed in 1984, is proof that justice doesn't have to be quick to be real. And maybe that's the biggest ripple of all. The reminder that time, for all its cruelty, can also be the thing that brings the truth to the surface. Chapter 14, A Mother's Resolve. When I think about the case of Shannon Rose Lloyd, one image stays with me more than any crime scene photograph, courtroom exchange, or forensic report. Patricia Lloyd sitting at her kitchen table with a spiral-bound notebook in front of her. The notebook wasn't anything special. Lined pages, a bent cover, the edges softened from years of turning. But inside was 37 years of persistence. Dates of phone calls to detectives. Names of people she'd spoken to. Newspaper clippings folded between pages. Sometimes just a single sentence scrawled in her neat, slanted handwriting. "No news this year." Patricia started it in 1984. The week after Shannon's funeral. "It was the only way I could keep track of what they told me," she said. "I didn't want to forget. And I didn't want them to forget me." For the first year, the entries came almost weekly. As the investigation slowed, the space between notes grew longer, months then years. But she never stopped. Every May 21st, the anniversary of Shannon's death, she would call the police. Even if there was nothing new, she wanted them to hear her voice, to know she was still waiting. Patricia's resolve didn't come from optimism alone. It came from a deep, steady refusal to let her daughter's name slip quietly into the past. "People think grief fades," she told me. "It doesn't. You just learn how to carry it. But if you're not careful, the world will try to bury it for you." I wasn't going to let that happen. Her persistence sometimes put her at odds with the police. In the 90s, when DNA was first making headlines, Patricia asked if Shannon's evidence could be tested. The answer was cautious but firm. "Not yet. The samples were too small, the technology not reliable enough." She accepted the explanation, but she wrote it down. Years later, when she asked again, she reminded them of that conversation. "If you write it down, they can't tell you they never said it," she said with a smile that was half pride, half defiance. When Detective Karen Holt took over the cold case unit in 2021, one of her first calls was to Patricia. Holt expected a wary reception. Families in long unsolved cases often greeted new detectives with polite skepticism. Instead, Patricia welcomed her. "If you think you can do something, I'll help you in any way I can," she told Holt. That help came in the form of memories Patricia had kept sharp through repetition. She knew exactly what Shannon had worn the last time she saw her. She remembered the names of friends and co-workers from 1984. She could list, without hesitation, the neighbors who had lived in Shannon's building that year. Many of those names had never made it into the official file. "You'd be surprised how often that happens," Holt told me later. "Families remember details that got missed the first time. Sometimes those details make all the difference." But for Patricia, the fight wasn't only about the case. It was about making sure Shannon's life was remembered beyond her death. She organized small memorials on anniversaries, gathering family and friends at the cemetery to share stories. She donated to domestic violence shelters in Shannon's name, even though Shannon's murder didn't fit that category. "It was about helping women stay safe," Patricia said. When the arrest finally came in 2021, Patricia was ready in a way few people could be after 37 years. She knew the trial would be draining. She knew the defense would try to undermine the evidence. But she also knew she'd finally get to look the man accused of killing her daughter in the eye. That moment came on the first day of the trial. Patricia sat in the front row as Hensley entered the courtroom. She didn't avert her gaze. She wanted him to know who she was and why she was there. "I didn't feel anger," she told me afterward. "I felt steady. I thought, this is the man who took my daughter, and he's not walking away this time." Throughout the proceedings, Patricia was a constant presence. She didn't miss a single day of testimony. She sat quietly, hands folded, listening as strangers described the most intimate and violent moments of her daughter's final night. She didn't flinch at the crime scene photos, though others in the courtroom looked away. After the verdict, when Hensley was found guilty, Patricia allowed herself a long, quiet exhale. She didn't celebrate in the courtroom. She saved that for home, where she lit a candle by Shannon's photo and let it burn into the night. At sentencing, Patricia delivered her impact statement without notes. Her voice was calm but unshakable. "For 37 years, I wondered if you'd ever be caught. I wondered if you'd ever have to answer for what you did. Now you will." She didn't cry. She didn't raise her voice. She spoke as someone who had been preparing for this moment for more than half her life. When I asked her later how she had kept going, she pointed to the same spiral notebook. "This," she said. "I wrote it all down. Every no. Every maybe. Every scrap of hope. You do that long enough, you build something that can't be erased." Patricia still keeps the notebook, though the last entry is dated the day of the verdict. She hasn't decided if she'll keep adding to it. "I guess that depends on whether I feel like the fight is really over." Because for Patricia, justice wasn't just about the arrest, or the trial, or the sentence. It was about making sure Shannon's name would never be just another unsolved file in a dusty evidence room. And in that, she succeeded. Chapter 15, The Final Word. Every case has an ending, but not every ending feels like it closes the story. Shannon Rose Lloyd's case is one of those rare few where the ending, though far from perfect, carries a sense of completion. When I sat down to write this final chapter, I went back over my notes from the past 2 years. Interviews, trial transcripts, forensic reports, and late-night conversations with Detective Karen Holt. I wanted to understand what this journey meant to each person who lived it. For Holt, the case was both a professional triumph and a personal awakening. "It reminded me why I became a detective," she told me. "Not for the easy cases, but for the ones that everyone else has given up on. It's easy to think of a 37-year-old murder as unsolvable. But every time you say unsolvable, you're making a choice to stop looking. This case taught me never to stop looking." For forensic analyst Paul Rivera, the case was a testament to the resilience of evidence. "We handle thousands of samples in a career," he said. "Most don't mean anything to us personally. They're just numbers on a form. But this one, every time I saw Lloyd Shannon R. on that envelope, I thought about how long her family had been waiting. That kind of responsibility changes how you work." Deputy District Attorney Michael Reyes reflected on the challenge of bridging the past and present in the courtroom. "We had to put the jury in two worlds at once. 1984, when DNA didn't exist as a tool, and 2021, when it's one of the strongest forms of evidence we have. The defense wanted to make those worlds incompatible. Our job was to show they were part of the same story, and that the story ended with the defendant in that chair. And then there was Patricia Lloyd. When I visited her one last time, she was in her garden, tending to the small patch of flowers she'd kept for decades. Shannon's favorite daisies bloomed near the walkway. Patricia's spiral notebook, the one that documented her decades of calls, questions, and refusals to let the case fade, sat on the porch table. She had added one more line since I last saw it. Justice served. "It doesn't bring her back," Patricia said softly. "But it means I can sleep at night without wondering if anyone will ever pay for what happened. It means I can put down the phone and stop asking. And it means Shannon's name will always be tied to the fact that we didn't give up." The ripple effects of Shannon's case are still unfolding. Other departments are testing old evidence because of it. Other families are finding their voices again. And in Garden Grove, the cold case unit now reviews every dormant homicide annually, a policy that didn't exist before Holt pushed for it. But perhaps the most important legacy is less tangible. It's the reminder that time doesn't erase truth. It only buries it. The truth is still there, waiting for the right combination of persistence, science, and people willing to keep the light on. As I close my notebook on this case, I'm left with one final image. It's not the crime scene or the courtroom, or even the verdict. It's Patricia in that garden, her hands in the soil, tending to something that will outlast her. She knows the flowers will need care again next season, but for now they're blooming. And that's enough.